2 months after a Tunisian fruit seller, Mohamed Bouazizi, set fire to himself after being bullied by officials, the flame he lit up symbolically continues to spread across North Africa and the Middle East. People Power has ousted two North African leaders since then, first in Tunisia, then in Egypt. There have also been pro-democracy demonstrations in Algeria, Iran, Bahrain, and Yemen. In Libya, where Colonel Muammar Gaddafi has a fearsome reputation for internal repression, protests have led to bloodshed on the streets. Human rights sources say more than 200 people have been killed in about 6 days of protests. The movement started in the east of the country and has now reached the capital, Tripoli. Protesters have accused the regime of hiring foreign mercenaries to put down the demonstrations. Sarah is a resident of Tripoli.
Which country they bring people from outside to kill people in their country? What kind of person brings people from outside of his own country if he claims to be from this country, if he claims to be Libyan? How can he bring people from outside to shoot and kill? And he knows that his people, they have nothing. We don't, not even just weapons, we have no food and water. He wants to bring for them to kill? To kill what? When is it, how much bloodshed, how many people have to die? Until somebody responds, until somebody says stop.
Another resident told the BBC that protesters were reluctant to come out on the streets of Tripoli because they feared being attacked.
People, they are still scared. People scared. We try to shout for people to come out. To come out, and people scared. I mean, I don't blame them. People scared to come out at the moment because they're not sure. I mean, last night we tried to, you know, we went to the TV station, tried to grab the TV station, and grab the radio station. At least we can talk to people about it.
Well, the Libyan government's response to the protests has been the bloodiest of any of the countries affected by demands for change. Several of Colonel Gaddafi's sons hold high-profile positions in public life. Last night, one of the most widely known of the sons, Saif al-Islam, said on state television that his father and security forces would fight until the last bullet. But even as he was speaking, there were clashes going on around Green Square in central Tripoli, which lasted until this morning. Today, the streets have been shut down by the security services. Dr. Mary Jane Deeb is a US-based specialist on Libya. On the line to Washington, D.C., I asked what she made of Saif al-Islam's stance on the protests.
Well, I suppose he was speaking as a representative of his father. He has always been the most important of the sons with respect to the political situation in Libya.
Usually he has, the face that he has given the world has been of a considerate and moderate reformer. But this seems like quite a hardline face that he has shown to the world in this speech on television last night.
Yes, indeed. I listened to him last night and I was rather surprised at the menacing tone that he used to address the Libyans. It's very unusual, but he did threaten them with violence, with the loss of services, with the splitting of the country, with the emergence of religious emirates. So yes, indeed, he was very threatening.
Why would he suddenly change like this, given that he's always come across as quite a moderate?
Well, he probably decided that there was no compromise that was going to be made with the people.
How are members of the Gaddafi family perceived by ordinary Libyans?
I believe that the ordinary Libyan today will not want any member of the family to be part of the ruling body in Libya. They want the whole family out of Libya.
Now, just before we spoke to you, we received reports of the Libyan justice minister resigning because of the excessive use of force on the civilian protesters. What do you make of that? Is this showing signs of major cracks in the government?
Absolutely. I mean, this is true also of the Libyan ambassador to the United Nations, who resigned as well. In other words, what you're seeing is the shift of people from the government to joining the ranks of the Libyan populace. So gradually, the very support upon which the Gaddafi regime relies may be floundering.
Dr. Mary Jane Deeb was talking to me from Washington, D.C. As protests mount against long-standing rulers in North Africa, another leader a little further south appears to have also been feeling the pressure. Officials from Sudan's governing party say that President Omar al-Bashir will not be running for another term when national elections come up in 4 years' time. Peter Martel reports from Juba in the south of Sudan.
Officials from Khartoum's ruling National Congress Party have announced what many opposition groups thought they might never hear, that President Omar al-Bashir will not be running when elections come round again in some 4 years' time. The opposition say that a worried Mr. Bashir is feeling the squeeze as neighbouring nations in North Africa are rocked by protests. Officials from his ruling party, however, stress that Mr. Bashir's announcement not to run is unconnected to that. The Sudanese capital has seen some sporadic protests since January, sparked by economic and political discontent, but the security forces have kept tight control and crushed street marches. Many too, however, point to Mr. Bashir as the man who failed to persuade former civil war enemies in the now soon-to-be-independent south of Sudan that it should remain in a united country. And with regional allies struggling at home, Mr. Bashir is unlikely to be able to look further afield for support. He still faces an international arrest warrant on genocide charges and crimes against humanity for the conflict in the western region of Darfur. For those who wish to see change, however, holding him to his word when those elections do finally come around may still be a tough task.
The BBC's Peter Martel in South Sudan. With growing international concern over the government crackdown on protesters in Libya, a doctor in Tripoli gives this first-hand account.
See a lot of people dying in front of me. There's a lot of dead people, and it was a massacre.
We consider the arms trade that supplies weapons to Libya.
It's not just companies that are trying to sell these weapons. It's the governance behind them, which are very much helping them.
Alone among its neighbours in North Africa and the Middle East, Libya is where pro-government forces have put up the fiercest fight against protesters demanding political reform. The UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights announced today that its sources within the country say that at least 250 people have been killed, with hundreds more injured. The BBC managed to get in touch with a doctor in the capital who did not wish to be named. She explained what she had seen in the past few days.
I'm a medical doctor and I'm working in a hospital and see a lot of people dying in front of me. They enforce us to treat the regime or militia rather than our people. And there's a lot of dead people, and it was a massacre, especially yesterday and day before.
The United Nations Security Council has begun discussions about the crisis in Libya. So too has the Arab League. On Monday night, the Libyan leader, Colonel Gaddafi, made his first televised appearance since the protests began. He said he wanted to dispel rumors that he had fled Tripoli. Colonel Gaddafi's former chief of protocol, Nuru al-Mizmari, who resigned from his post on Monday, said in an interview that he did not think that Mr. Gaddafi would be prepared to step down and that peace talks would be unsuccessful.
He's trying to enter into dialogue with the chief of tribes to calm the situation. Rumors that they've been running, he's been running out of the country. He's not. He's staying there, and he will be staying there. He will not step down. But after all this killing and this bloodshed, people will not accept anymore to enter in dialogue. Too late. Lot of killing, lot of blood, lot of innocent dead.
Well, there's a BBC reporter in Tripoli. She gave us this description of the current state of affairs in the Libyan capital. We cannot name her for security reasons.
It's impossible to make any international call. It's very difficult to receive any international call, especially on mobile lines. Yesterday, there was no way at all to talk to anyone, but today we've managed to speak to some locals here, whether inside Tripoli or in other cities, especially in the city of Benghazi. We've got some information telling us that yesterday there was a heavy conflict gunfire, shooting, and they couldn't verify the number of people who were killed, because also the army prevented anyone to send any casualties to hospitals. Even doctors are warned and are terrified not to pass on information to anyone, but we've managed through some local contacts here to get some information. So far, it seems to be the army here is still in control of Tripoli. There are armed and unarmed forces. The definitely armed forces that I've seen from the army are spread in sensitive areas where there are key government offices and around areas that have embassy presence. But throughout the streets, there is heavy civilian dressed security in across the city. They are present there. They're trying to monitor every movement, and we've definitely heard of the presence of snipers who are located on almost every top of the building to watch out for any suspicious movement and shoot immediately.
A BBC correspondent in Tripoli. Questions about arms supplies to Libya have been raised in Great Britain, one of the leading exporters of military hardware. Several days ago, the British government here announced a ban on weapons exports to Libya and Bahrain. To find out the scale of arms sales to Libya, I called up Peter Weserman, a senior researcher at the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute.
Well, Libya has, in total numbers, not been a very big importer of weapons, but it wanted to be. It had been negotiating for contracts for quite significant numbers of weapons with a vast range of countries. And if those contracts would have gone through, then it would have become a significant player in the arms market in the coming years, especially.
You say a lot of contracts with a vast range of countries. Can you give us an idea of how many countries and how they are spread?
Well, they're basically all over the place. I mean, Russia has been very important, but also France, the UK, Italy, smaller countries like Belgium and Serbia, and even the US has shown some interest. And I can give you a few examples, like a French company signed a contract for the refurbishment of existing Libyan combat aircraft, two of which actually landed yesterday in Malta after they defected. The United Kingdom, there's a company there which supplied communication gear, which is being used in tanks, which are being used by the elite brigade of Gaddafi's armed forces. So, yeah, a number of deals have gone through.
I understand that Italy stands out in the sense that it has a special arrangement with Libya to try to, in a way, get Libya to help it curb illegal immigration across the Mediterranean into Italy. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yes, that's absolutely true. Italy has a major interest in stopping migrants going from Libya to Italy. And so they've helped Gaddafi in several ways with setting up better border controls. And so, for example, one Italian company called Finmeccanica got a major deal worth hundreds of millions of dollars to install border control equipment along the borders of Libya. And so, yeah, Italy plays an important role, and this is important to realize. This kind of equipment, surveillance equipment, communication equipment, can also be used elsewhere in Libya and can, for example, in principle, be used now to give the armed forces of Gaddafi eyes and ears in its fight against demonstrations.
Now, as these protests have been going on in Libya, some governments like the United Kingdom have declared bans on arms exports both to Libya and Bahrain. What do you make of that?
Well, it's very good that they do so now, and that they do so shows some restraint, but it really makes you wonder, why did they allow those arms sales in the first place? Why did the UK allow earlier sales of weapons, and why not only were they allowing actual sales, but also really pushing for arms? Because you shouldn't forget that it's not just companies that are trying to sell these weapons, it's the governance behind them, which are very much helping them. I mean, high-level politicians up to the level of presidents or prime minister have visited Libya and tried to market military equipment to Gaddafi in the knowledge that this man is a dictator and in the knowledge that there was a risk that he might use those weapons against his own population. So it's good that they have restraints now, but it does seem a bit late.
That was Peter Weserman from the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. Well, eyewitnesses who've seen the crackdown on the anti-government protests in Libya say some of the security forces are foreign mercenaries, and there have been reports that these so-called mercenaries were recruited from sub-Saharan Africa, which the Libyan government has denied. So how plausible is this? And if so, where did they come from? To shed some light on this, my colleague Paul Bachibinga spoke to Adam Cham, a Malian journalist in Bamako.
Thousands of Tuaregs who were enrolled in the Pan-Arabic army of Gaddafi were demobilized in the 90s. Many of them came to Mali and to Niger, and they started the rebellion in Mali in June 90, and a year later in Niger. But 10,000, that's the figure which was given to us at that time, remained in Libya, and they are enrolled in the Libyan security forces. And I was told that 600 of them was forming the special unit in Benghazi, and probably that is part of this group was used in the repression of the Benghazi movement.
So could it be right, or is it right, what the Libyan authorities were saying, the Libyan authorities under Colonel Gaddafi, that these are actually Libyans? Could they have naturalized as Libyan citizens?
Oh, no, they are definitely Libyans. I mean, they are Libyans accepted more by Gaddafi than the other Libyans, and that is exactly what is worrying us in Mali. In case Colonel Gaddafi goes, we don't know what will happen to 10,000 Tuaregs armed living in Libya and who are not accepted by the population. I mean, the likelihood for them to come back to Mali is so high that it's frightening.
So the Mali authorities are concerned?
Oh, yes, the Malian authorities have been concerned by this problem for the last 20 years. And this is even one of the reasons why, I mean, the cooperation with Libya is very strong.
But has there been any reaction from the Malian government to these developments?
No, because it's nothing official. I mean, no one has told the Malian government that the Tuaregs, I mean, they are Libyans today, were used to repress the movement in Benghazi.
Adam Cham, a Malian journalist in Bamako.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm James Kimara-Sami with NewsHour. It was, in many ways, vintage Colonel Gaddafi. After his brief overnight cameo from the back of a car under an umbrella, his latest television appearance was much longer, much more defiant, and much more rambling. Swathed in brown robes and a turban, the Libyan leader spoke for an hour and a half on state television in what appeared to be the Bab al-Azizia barracks in Tripoli that were damaged in a 1986 US air raid. There were no adoring crowds, just one man, his green book, and an unsuppressed rage against protesters who've been posing the biggest threat to his rule in more than four decades. As he spoke, the camera frequently panned away to a statue of a fist holding an American warplane, a visual accompaniment to a belligerent speech which could herald a new bloodier stage in the crackdown against his opponents, a speech which had at its centre not so much the fate of one country, but of one man, Muammar Gaddafi.
أنا أرفع من المناصب التي يتقلدها الرؤساء والأبهات.
I rise above the post that other president aspire to. I am a fighter. I am a fighter from the countryside, from the country. I fight in cities and towns. I led a historic revolution that brought honor to the Libyans. Generation after generation, Libya will be leading the whole world, Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Nobody can stop this historic march. Those hired people, those mice and cats who are fleeing from one street to another during darkness. I challenge them. I am paying the price for so that I can stay here. My grandfather Abdeslam Banyar was the first to fall during a battle. I cannot harm this martyrdom. I'm unable. I cannot leave the honorable soil of my country. I will die a martyr at the end.
Well, let's get an assessment of that speech. We can speak now to Najla Abu Meri, a correspondent with the BBC Arabic service. Najla, we'll come on to the rhetoric in a minute, but what about the setting? This was one man on his own railing, really, against those who would dare to oppose him.
Well, as you said, the setting, well, let's start from the palace. You mentioned already, I had this clip that it's like it was hit from a U.S. An airstrike, an American airstrike in 1986. So basically, Gaddafi trying from this place exactly to send a message that he's, you know, kind of this the first revolutionist, or, you know, he's defending Libya against all this conspiracy, exterior conspiracy that he already mentioned it in his speech in details, that it's all like outside political manipulative power, that it's, you know, manipulating the street, and it's not the honest youth in the Libyan society. So
and in that clip, really, the cult of Gaddafi.
Yeah, so basically he's talking about himself, that he's the leader, he's going to die in his land. And he also, in other part of you know, the speech, which is confirming what we already heard, he said, "I only have my gun and I will fight until the last drop of blood, and with me the Libyan people." He was emotional, he has a trembling voice, he was slamming the podium with his fist. So basically he was trying just to play on the emotion level of the Libyan people, saying raise up and let's defend Libya. But we should also remember that he all the time linked Libya to himself, to his personality, and he didn't you know, hide it this time in the speech. He said that I am Libya, Libya start to be important on the world platform because of me. So this ego that he was showing, basically he was showing that he's remaining in power, he's not defeated yet. And this is why he was angry and upset, because he was maybe surprised that all this legacy of 40 years ruling with iron fist, and now he's trembling and he's losing all this power for 40
well,
years.
That's what he's had to say about himself. Let's have a listen about what he had to say about those who would oppose him. Less than honourable words, I suppose you would say. We heard references to mice and cats, so there were some other animals mentioned as well.
What's happened to you? Why are you worried and afraid from these gangs? What's happened to you? These gangs, like cockroaches, they don't represent anything. They're not even 1% of a million of the Libyan people. They're nothing. They were a handful of people who are trying to imitate what's happened in Tunisia and Egypt. They were drugged. They were given orders. These are cockroaches. As from tomorrow, security should be established through the police and the army. Police and the police should impose security. All roadblocks should be removed tomorrow. Chase them everywhere.
Najla, drugged cockroaches.
Yeah, Jamie, I think he's really underestimating the Libyan people, and this will have a bad effect, you know, not what Gaddafi leader is really like hoping to see in the coming days. Really underestimating the Libyan people and showing them, as, you know, all the time they are manipulated by other factors, whether political exterior power or drugs or extremists. And this is not what the Libyan people would like to hear, neither the Arab, you know, people around the Arab world, because basically what they are trying to send him the message that we are fed up, we are on the level to govern ourselves by ourselves within a constitution, that it's really like there's lack of constitution in Libya. So basically, I think all this insults and swearing that we heard when he addressed the protesters will not give him the feedback, the good feedback that he's waiting for. I doubt
What are people thinking when they listen to that? Because he's been around for many years. People have heard long speeches, pretty fiery rhetoric. What do people listening to that speech, his audience, think when they hear that kind of rhetoric, do you think?
First of all, I think, you know, the followers or the Arab world or, and in Libya, they are used to hear this long speeches from Gaddafi specifically. And I think yesterday when we saw him in this like short 22 seconds clip, it was amazing to see him really in this short and brief way. However, this during the speech, I was following, you know, Twitters and Facebook users. They were all the time in irony way, in sarcastic way, they were mocking him, saying that we had enough, we cannot handle this insanity and craziness for longer, he should step down. Some people, they were saying, we are tired to tweet this speech. So I think he has nothing to offer, really, for to open dialogue or to appeal the aspiration of his own people or the international community.
Okay, now just yeah, one second. Let's move away from the mockery to, well, what he has promised, because people may mock, but he has indeed promised the strongest possible retribution against those protesters.
Officers have been deployed in all tribes and regions so that they can purify all these regions from these cockroaches. And they will try to apprehend the young people and put them on trial. This is their punishment according to the law. I mean, the law, the penal law in Libya, that's before the revolution, is written here. The Libyan, anybody who takes arms against the Libyan will be executed. Any Libyan who takes arms against Libya will be executed.
Nadja, just stay with us because we can go live now to Tripoli and we can speak to the BBC correspondent there, who we can't name for security reasons. That threat from Colonel Gaddafi, threat of violence, of retribution, any sign yet that anyone is following through with that?
No sign yet of any escalation in the streets. We only heard people, supporters of Colonel Gaddafi celebrating in the streets. There was some random gunfire shooting, but we can't confirm if that was because of fighting going on with potential protesters or because supporters of Colonel Gaddafi are just firing in the air because they're celebrating. We've heard earlier in the day that the protesters were planning a big demonstration today that was supported by people who joined from outside Tripoli, but so far we can't confirm of any action that has taken place.
And there have been reports that Colonel Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, is due to give some kind of press conference. Is there any clues to what he might want to talk about?
Well, listening to what he had said yesterday, where he basically made an offer for dialogue and reform, otherwise, if they didn't listen to him, the answer is civil war and bloodshedding. And after the defiant and rather threatening speech that his father made today, with very worrying messages that he sent to the country, we might expect Saif al-Islam to come out and make a final offer to for a dialogue to calm down the situation. Obviously, Colonel Gaddafi's speech today shows that he is losing grip. He is fighting his last battle. He already lost control over the eastern of the country, and there is concern that his days are counted.
Well, and one other development, it's been reported, hasn't it, that his interior minister has defected and has called on the armed forces essentially to back the protesters.
Exactly, and that's another element that is worrying for the ruler who ruled Libya for 42 years and had control over over the situation. It started with ambassadors defecting, and then pilots leaving to Malta and refusing to follow orders, and now a key minister, which is the interior minister. These are all signs that he is not even control of his own forces.
Okay, our correspondent there in Tripoli, thanks very much. Let's go back to Najla Abu Meri from the BBC Arabic service. Would you say that is a significant development, the interior minister defecting?
Yes, it is significant, and also we could add it to other defections from other, you know, Libyan diplomatic and officials around the world in UN and in India and other countries. We could say that, you know, speaking of Gaddafi term, whether he's losing his power or not, definitely he's losing his power, and I think he's aware of this, and that's why he's threatening people. Although we heard Saif al-Islam the night before, he was kind of offering, you know, to open the door of dialogue. But it's the same scenario that it's repeating itself in Egypt and in Tunisia and now in Libya, when we hear the leader often and often saying that he's willing to do some kind of concessions. However, he's threatening people. We should also remember that still the internet and, you know, there's no Twitter, no Facebook, no mobile phones is working in Libya. And when we witness this in Egypt during, you know, 3 or 4 days, we had around 400 people killed. So we could feel the sense that something is going on.
Okay, Najla, we have to leave it there. Najla Abu Mehri there from the BBC Arabic Service. You're listening to NewsHour. And coming up later on in the programme, we'll be hearing from a resident of Tripoli who was following Colonel Gaddafi's televised speech.
During the speech, I was hearing gunshots starting and a lot of areas. He's trying to put fear in people. He's trying to let people not go out and not protest. Nobody can really tell what's happening. Part of the country is dead, but another part of it is it's alive with gunshots.
And a reminder of our main headlines at this hour. The Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi has called on his supporters to take to the streets and defeat those who are demonstrating against his leadership. He said he would purge Libya house by house if necessary. The United Nations is considering its response to the turmoil in Libya, and differences have emerged between Libyan diplomats at the assembly. And 4 Americans captured by Somali pirates have been killed. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. And we were hearing there from Najla about the problems in communication. We've been trying to patch together what information we can get from around the country. In fact, the BBC's Pascal Harter has been doing just that. She's been trying to build up a picture of what's going on. So, Pascal, at this hour, what have you been able to find out?
That there is still a lot of fear in Tripoli, and whereas people in the east of the country, in the city of Benghazi, for example, where protesters after bloody reprisals at the weekend are in control, in Tripoli there is a lot of fear that Colonel Gaddafi, in his speech, was making a threat that he could really come good on. We've also seen some images which have been sent by email when it was working in Libya and posted by protesters, so it's very much from their perspective, but that protesters claim show snipers on the streets. Now, this does tally with what we've been hearing from multiple sources in Tripoli, that mercenaries have been put on top of buildings and that they've been picking protesters off one by one before they can amass in a large crowd. That seems to be the tactic, and it also explains why you can speak to one person in Tripoli and they can say it's very quiet where I am, there's nothing happening, and then in another part of the town small groups of would-be protesters are being shot at, we understand.
One thing we have been able to monitor is the speech by Colonel Gaddafi. Is there any sense that it has changed anything?
Well, the view on Twitter seems to be, and I'm talking about the English and Arabic tweets, basically two things. On the one hand, Muammar Gaddafi has been completely ridiculed by Libyans too, who say, is he crazy? Why was he pretending to speak to a large crowd when you could see in the reflection of his glasses that nobody was there except for a few adoring soldiers and his camera crew? On the other hand, there are a lot of fearful Libyans, some outside the country, worried for their family within, who say, do not underestimate this man. He's made fierce talk, and they're scared that he is going to exact revenge in the way that we've seen really people attacked in Benghazi. Some very brutal images, again, that we cannot verify, but disturbing images coming out of there. It also seems to have shaken some of the people who say they were lifelong Gaddafi supporters, really, because they've done well out of his Libya. Here's one person that I spoke to who told me that he has always supported Gaddafi.
لا مش عاجبني بس يعني في هو يجب يكون في اصلاح في البلاد لان الخطاب هذا نسمع فيه من قبل
I have money. I don't have any problems. but I see the country needs reforms and improvements in its governance. All of the ministers, they're thieves. Gaddafi, in his speech, said he will punish them and he will investigate what they did. I think this needs to happen because Gaddafi gives billions of dollars to the country every year, but the government just takes it for themselves. But this speech is just the same as the others in the past. It's nothing new, just promises of reforms and improvements, but nothing new ever happens.
Sir, you said that you aren't sure what will happen after Gaddafi. Are you positive that he is going to leave power?
I don't care whether he stays or not. What I care about is the stability of my country and punishing the criminals and all those who are corrupt and cause problems for my country. Whether or not Gaddafi steps down, that doesn't matter to me. What matters is my country.
What do you think about the bloodshed of protesters?
I'm against killing people, especially when they demonstrate peacefully. They just want reforms and improvements in their economic conditions. I don't think Gaddafi himself orders to kill them. The one who's responsible for this is his son, Khamis, who's the leader of the army.
That was the view of one lifelong Gaddafi supporter.
And Pascal, we've been hearing from some people that we've managed to get through to in Tripoli that they feel, as protesters, that if they got support from the east, where there's a lot stronger protest movement, that would help. Is there any sign that people from Benghazi are coming to Tripoli or planning to come to Tripoli?
Absolutely. That support is waiting in the wings. Just before coming in to speak to you, Jamie, I was speaking to somebody who's a protester here in London, Libyan, in contact every moment, really, with people in Benghazi, unable to get through on the phones to Tripoli. And the protesters there say that they have got medical supplies ready, some of which have been brought over by Egyptians, ordinary Egyptians, piling their cars high, driving across the border to help out the Libyans who'd been attacked by their own government. And these protesters in Benghazi said, we need to support the youth in Tripoli, and they want to get there, they say, as soon as possible, as soon as it's safe. There's a lot of fear, though, that Muammar Gaddafi, even if he is making his last stand, that that last stand's going to be violent.
Pascal Harter, thanks for that roundup. Well, it's against this backdrop of confusion and of that speech from Colonel Gaddafi that the United Nations Security Council is now holding a formal meeting to discuss the situation in Libya. We can join our correspondent at the UN in New York, Barbara Plett, now. Barbara, I understand the Libyan delegation has been speaking, although some confusion about whether they're speaking with one voice.
Yes, that's right. The Security Council meeting started with briefings from an official of the Secretary General, but also from the Libyan ambassador, who it had been expected that it would be the deputy ambassador briefing the council, since it was the deputy who asked for the meeting, asking the Security Council to intervene and protect Libyan civilians against what he called a genocide by Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. But since that call, the ambassador himself has returned to the scene, and he's the one who ended up talking to the council. I don't have many details about what exactly he said, because it was a closed meeting, but we understand that he denied all the reports that planes were being used against the protesters, but he did admit that the east of the country, the government, was no longer in control.
And in terms of what the others listening, the other members of the Security Council, have been saying, or hints they've been giving before this meeting, is there any sense of unity?
Well, we understand that there's a fairly good consensus in terms of coming out with a statement that will condemn the violence, probably call for respect of human rights and international law. There are some other elements being debated as well. One of them is a call for an international investigation into the alleged atrocities in the east of the country, and for the no longer intimidating journalists, and for easing curbs on the internet, and also for guaranteeing access to human rights monitors and humanitarian supplies.
What about the idea of a no-fly zone? Is that going to go anywhere?
That is not actually being debated at the moment. A no-fly zone would require a resolution with legal authority, and that's quite a long process. It's the kind of thing the Security Council could do, but it doesn't do it very often, almost never, as a matter of fact. And there was enough effort to actually get the Security Council to put Libya on the agenda at all, since this is the first time they've done so with any of the Arab revolts. So starting it with a no-fly zone is really a no-go.
But as you say, it is on the agenda, and that is different to what has happened in the other countries. That does suggest at least that they believe that the situation is sufficiently serious to warrant some kind of joint action.
Yes, I think they probably see it as different from the other countries in terms of the scale of violence being reported. We were also told that the speech given by Colonel Gaddafi, in which he made many threats and was very defiant, hardened the resolve of those nations who want a relatively strong statement. And I think there may be more concern about this leading to chaos inside the country, which could spill over the borders, all of which is motivating the council. And then, of course, you had that direct request by the deputy ambassador, which is what got this started in the first place.
And a sense from the Americans, we heard from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, that there needs to be some unified, concerted approach.
Yes, I think that's the desire of the United States and also of certainly the Western nations who are driving this, that they want a unified message from the international community. They want basically the line drawn in the sand so that whenever there is disunity among the states of the world body, then often there are loopholes and the pressure isn't as strong. I mean, I'm not sure how much pressure is actually going to change Colonel Gaddafi's mind.
Okay, we have to leave it there. Barbara Plett, live at the United Nations. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm James Kamara-Sami with NewsHour. As we've been hearing, the United Nations Security Council is meeting in New York at the moment. They're discussing what to do about the situation in Libya, although, as our correspondent at the UN was telling us just a short while ago, they don't appear to be discussing that call from Libya's deputy ambassador for a no-fly zone over the country. Well, one of those who does believe that should happen is the former British Foreign Secretary Lord Owen. He served as a UN peace envoy during the Bosnian War of the 1990s. I've been speaking to Lord Owen, and I asked him how he wanted the international community to proceed.
I'd like to see them mandate a resolution to say that this is a potentially humanitarian disaster in Libya and that the Security Council would call for a no-fly zone over Libyan airspace for any military aircraft. And once that was carried through under the UN Charter, they could ask the regional organization like NATO to organize it, and it could operate from the moment the resolution is passed. Now, there are airfields with strike aircraft which could enforce a no-fly zone, both from Cyprus, from Italy, and there are aircraft carriers, I gather, in the Mediterranean. So we have the capability. It might be possible to get some of the Egyptian Air Force to also help, which would be advantageous, that it was not seen entirely as a Western, but as a UN initiative. And I think it would also act as a considerable disincentive to any Libyan pilots doubtful about the propriety of such action, deciding to not cooperate. Now, we can't intervene on the ground. Everybody knows that's not something that's possible. But we can stop Gaddafi threatening his own people with their own air force.
Well, that is the problem, though, isn't it? Because if the humanitarian crisis is taking place on the ground, if it is squads of people shooting indiscriminately, as some of the reports have suggested, that is where the real urgency is, isn't it?
Well, there's an urgency there, but I can tell you that the amount of people killed and the carnage would be ever greater if we start seeing bombing from the air. We've seen this before, you know. I know there are cynical people who think this can't be done, but those cynical people often argued against the no-fly zone, which John Major and President Mitterrand and Bush Sr. implemented in Iraq to help and save the Kurdish people.
What about the institution of the United Nations in this particular case, given that Libya has been a member of the Human Rights Council? Does it not erode some of the legitimacy from the UN taking this kind of action?
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, I personally deplore the fact that some countries in the groupings that are set up to vote in people did agree to put Libya on the human rights. But we've had countries on human rights committees whose human rights record have been appallingly bad. I must say, I can't think of any country worse than Libya. Look, I'm the last person in the world to argue that the UN, in all respects, is a wonderful organization. It has its considerable weaknesses, but it also has some strengths when you use it wisely. Anyhow, it's the only organ we have for any form of international authority.
So are you saying that this could be a moment when that the UN, perhaps with America playing a key role, can redefine itself?
The UN always gets the tasks that the rest of the world don't want to do by themselves, and they're very difficult tasks. Because of the geography, because of the closeness of the airfields, we are in a position to do something. There are other parts of the Middle East where we would not be able to intervene, where we don't have the capacity in the region to do so. But in this one, we've got this limited but important capacity to try and prevent an even greater humanitarian disaster than has already emerged in Libya.
And that was the former UN peace envoy, former British Foreign Secretary, Lord Owen there. Well, let us know what you think about the situation in Libya, especially if you're listening in the country. Our email address, worldhaveyoursay@bbc.com, or you can go to our Facebook page, BBC NewsHour. Some of you have been posting your comments. Ewan McDonald says, I think Western people should be a bit ashamed at the fact that we've let our democratic governments prop up so many of these dictators, kings and corrupt presidents for decades. Some of the blood of these people is on our hands. Well, the violence that's been taking place in Libya is of concern to many. The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has called for an end to all the violence against the opponents of Colonel Gaddafi, but she said that the United States would act in concert with the international community. Well, a few hours ago, my colleague Paul Henley got through to a protester in Tripoli whose name we're not giving for her own safety.
During the speech where Gaddafi had made a very clear statement of what he is intending to do, I was hearing gunshots starting in a lot of areas. I tried to contact the people I know, and they all confirmed that it's happening in different areas in Tripoli. There are different helicopters moving around in the area where I'm staying right now, but I can assure you that's not happening in one area alone. He's trying to put fear in people. He's trying to let people not go out and not protest off the speech he made just now.
And we've been sent pictures which purport to be bodies on the streets of Tripoli. Have you seen bodies on the streets?
He is trying so hard to hide every trace of the mascara he is doing. I have seen only one body so far being dragged in front of me, but that's it. I cannot really say the number of bodies has been shot, but it's definitely over 200 people has been shot between 2 days ago and now.
And that's your estimate. Have you taken part in the protest yourself, yes?
No. So far I have been doing I've been doing the media contacts and trying to report what's been happening, but my cousin has been out. My cousin has been shot. A cousin of mine has been shot in his leg and his chest, and he's hospitalized right now.
Who do you think he was shot by?
He was shot by black people, people who are recruited from outside the country.
All right. Are you indoors now? Are you scared to go outside, in fact?
I am not that much of scared, Dan. I am curious of what's happening right now outside, because nobody can really tell what's happening. Part of the country is dead, but another part of it is it's alive with gunshots.
And if it's not a daft question, are you scared of any reprisals for talking to us?
No.
Well, Mohamed Abdel Malik is a Libyan who has lived in Britain for a number of years. He runs Libya Watch, which has been monitoring human rights abuses in Libya for 10 years. I asked him what he'd been hearing from inside the country.
I've been in contact with family members and friends and other people whose contacts we've got. And it's more of the same, really. Gunshots, they're using heavy artillery. They're even using anti-aircraft machine guns, which would penetrate more than one person. We know for a fact that helicopters and jet fighters were hovering in the sky. Whether they actually bombed parts of Tripoli or not, we cannot confirm, but we've heard a lot that they are using these aircrafts to bomb parts of Libya. My sister has fled her house in the Girgarish area because she told me, and she was very, very scared when she called me. And the fact that she called me speaks for itself, because usually it's I who call her. And she was very, very scared. And she kept saying to me, because she knows my position in Libya Watch, she kept saying to me, do something, do something, help us, help us. We're being murdered, we're being massacred. And I, you know, tried to calm her down and said, well, tell me what is happening. And she said that she was so afraid that she had to leave her house in Girgarish area because she was hearing many shots and bombs and mortar.
And where's she going?
She went to my house in Tripoli city center, where my brother lives now, and that's where she's staying now.
And are you hearing that from other families, people moving around, fleeing from violence to other parts of the country?
Yeah, there are those who are willing to talk. My sister actually only speaks to me. She doesn't want to speak to anyone else. But there are those who want to talk, and one lady has told me for a fact, and I do trust her very well because I know her personally. She said that they have vacated tall buildings, high-rises in Tripoli from the inhabitants, and they have placed in them snipers to shoot the crowd and the people in the streets.
Is most of the violence concentrated in Tripoli now? Is this what is happening? It clearly moved from the east of the country to Tripoli, or are you hearing reports in other cities as well?
We've heard just a few hours ago that they were attacking Benghazi as well. We hope not. We hope it's a rumor. But yes, the concentration now is in Tripoli, because the only part of Tripoli that is still in the hands of Colonel Gaddafi and his supporters is the barracks of Bab al-Aziziyah. Bab al-Aziziyah is the district that was taken over by the army, and it has been turned into a camp, and that's where the national radio and TV station are, and that's why the people could not take control of the national radio and TV station, because they're bang in the middle of the camp where Gaddafi and his family and his supporters are hiding, and they are very well protected. They've got weapons, loads of it. Some of it, of course, most of it comes from the West. And frankly speaking, they are very well secured in that area. And I'm sure it will cause a lot of sacrifices to try to overrun that area or take it.
And that was Mohammed Abdel Malik, who runs Libya Watch here in Britain. And he was referring there to reports of warplanes attacking people in Libya. Just to let you know, to remind you that the ambassador, the Libyan ambassador to the United Nations, speaking just a short while ago, denied that warplanes had been used. Well, whatever is happening inside Libya, the ominous tone of Colonel Gaddafi's speech is likely to increase the numbers of people trying to leave the country, both Libyans who are trying to leave via the eastern border with Egypt and foreigners who've already been scrambling to escape. Serbia, Russia, the Netherlands and France, they're among countries which have said that they're sending planes to Tripoli to evacuate their citizens, while Britain is redeploying a warship, the HMS Cumberland, off the Libyan coast for a possible seaborne evacuation of its citizens. But what about the huge number of people who work under the radar in Libya as labourers and who don't have the documents or indeed the money to escape? I've been speaking about that to Jean-Philippe Chauzy. He's a spokesman for the International Organization for Migration in Geneva. I began by asking him how many of those undocumented workers were currently living in Libya.
We only have estimates anything between 700,000 to 1.5 million. These are migrant workers who are employed in the informal sector of the Libyan economy. They come from West Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa, also from the Horn of Africa, obviously from neighboring Egypt, Tunisia, Morocco, the Maghreb countries. Now, these are people in the past who have suffered from xenophobic violence, and obviously we at IOM are concerned about their security and also keen to help them as much as we can, especially for those who would manage to leave Libya and go to Egypt or to neighboring Tunisia. See whether we can provide some assistance, return and reintegration assistance, as we did, for instance, in 2006 in Lebanon during the war.
What sort of information do you have about them? There have been reports, haven't there, of some being held hostage by pro-Gaddafi supporters?
Yes, that's correct. We're getting anecdotal evidence of threats and violence against these migrant workers. Again, it's very difficult to get accurate information from the ground from what's happening inside Libya, but we know, unfortunately, from past experiences that foreign workers in Libya have borne the brunt of xenophobic violence. Obviously, we are concerned and we're keen to assist and also to respond from increasing calls from some of our member states who are asking us to try and evacuate their nationals, countries that haven't got the financial means or the logistical capacity to evacuate their nationals. Now, of course, this is going to be pretty difficult. It's not going to happen from inside Libya at the moment. So we're looking at setting up an infrastructure, getting the funding to assist those who hopefully will be able to make it across the borders to Egypt and to Tunisia. And, of course, we would need the green light from those two countries to start the humanitarian evacuation of those foreign workers.
Well, two countries which are going through quite a few changes of their own. What kind of capacity do they have to take in what could be quite large numbers of migrants?
Well, they probably haven't. That's why, or let's say the capacity needs to be cranked up quite considerably. That's why, in a way, organizing a evacuation, if you want, for those third country nationals who make it to Egypt and to Tunisia, very much along the lines of what we did at the time in 2006 in Lebanon, evacuating about 13,000 mostly domestic workers out of Lebanon and then flying them back to the Philippines, to Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and all those countries of origin. That could be a possibility. But there again, I mean, the speed of which events have unfolded in Libya is pushing us to scramble as much as we can, as best as we can, to address those potential needs.
And we were hearing there from Jean-Philippe Chosy, the spokesman for the International Organization for Migration, on those people trying to get out of Libya. Well, we're getting some text messages on the events taking place inside Libya. This from William in Monrovia. He says, what the people of Libya want is to hear that Gaddafi should resign and call it a day. Gaddafi, the time has come to leave. Leave now and stop killing innocent people. But caution being urged from Mohammed in Ombe in Nigeria. He says, I'm calling on Libyans to handle this era of change wisely. The devil you know is better, he says, than the angel you don't. If you go to our website, bbc.com/news, you can follow a live page which is giving us all the updates on what is happening in Libya and throughout the region. This, for example, a tweet from Saskia Isserif. Libyan army deploys in Sabrata, west of Tripoli, after protesters destroy government buildings. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm James Kamara-Sami with NewsHour. And a reminder of today's main news. The Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi has called on his supporters to take to the streets and defeat those demonstrating against his leadership. He said he would purge Libya house by house if necessary and would never leave the country.
Those hired people, those mice and cats who are fleeing from one street to another during darkness. I challenge them. I am paying the price for so that I can stay here. I cannot leave the honourable soil of my country. I will die a martyr at the end.
And in other news at this hour, the Algerian government says it's lifting a state of emergency that's been in place for almost two decades. And four Americans captured by Somali pirates have been killed. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. And as we've been hearing, Colonel Gaddafi has given a long speech in which he has attacked those who have been rising up against him and has said he will stand and fight till the end. He will never leave his country. What did we learn about the Colonel from his speech? Well, I've been speaking to somebody who's interviewed him several times, Marie Colvin, Foreign Affairs Correspondent for the Sunday Times here in the UK. She watched the speech closely. Did she think we saw the old Colonel Gaddafi again?
That was indeed the old Colonel Gaddafi. There was a odd moment last night when he sort of came out under an umbrella and went back under the umbrella. But tonight I saw the Gaddafi I knew. I first interviewed Gaddafi. He was in the Bab al-Zazia barracks when Ronald Reagan, the American president, was about to bomb him. And he showed up for the interview in a red Nehru silk jacket and pajama pants and high-heeled lizard skin shoes and over it all a gold cape and said, "What do you want?" And I said, "Actually, I want to know what you think about the fact that the American president is about to bomb you."
You didn't ask him where the shoes were from?
No, actually, I'm really into shoes. But I said, "What do you think the American people should know?" And he said, "I think the American people should know I have no house. That's what they should know." So
the American
speech today did not surprise me.
No, and I mean, he made a lot of references to historical events, not just that, you know, the bombing of his own country. We kept seeing, as I mentioned earlier, that shot of the that statue of the fist grabbing the American plane. Lots of references to foreigners. Lots of references to the fact that you know, the Americans would come in and make Libya another Afghanistan.
Well, I know that's very Libyan, and the whole thing. I mean, I've just come from. I was in Tunis for the revolution in Tunis, and in Egypt. But just been in Egypt and the revolution in Egypt. It's a youth bomb. They are so fed up. And you can't do what Gaddafi does, which is the state television dripping poison. Every single moment, they say, a state television says that it is a foreign-inspired revolution. It is not. The difference in Libya is that he's willing to shoot people.
Well, that's right. I mean, when he talks about being a martyr, fighting to the last bullet, do you think the rest of the world should take him at his word?
I don't think Gaddafi saying, "I'm a martyr, I'm ready to fight to the last bullet," is the relevant thing here. He's willing to shoot his people. And both in Egypt and in Tunis, both of the armies said, "We're not going to shoot our own people." And that's what we are looking at that is different, and that is going to be what changes Libya. Gaddafi will live or die by whether what his army does, not by what he does.
So do you think there are any circumstances under which he would give up power, be forced out, if his army turned against him?
Good question. I don't. I mean, it's a roll of the dice a bit, but I think Gaddafi, if you watch that speech, and I've talked to him over the years, he speaks and plays the role of the sort of Rousseau-like man. If you saw the speech and in interviews I have had with him, I am not a president, I am not a prime minister, I have no role, I have no title. In fact, in the speech tonight, he said, if I had a title, I would throw it away, I would resign. Of course he has a title. He pretends that the country is led by people's committees. It is led by Gaddafi. It is led by his sons. He will do what he wants to do there. And I, the people of Libya are going to be the victims.
And that was Marie Colvin of the Sunday Times.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Tim Franks with NewsHour. The battle for the control of Libya remains unresolved, although, as you'll hear later in the programme, Tripoli itself was strangely quiet today, at least in part according to one resident we spoke to, for the rather humdrum reason that the weather has been cold and wet. But the uncertainty and the fear continue. Reliable accounts of what's happening are difficult. Foreign journalists are banned. So what do we know? The spokesman for the International Federation of Human Rights, Martin Pretel, gave us his estimate of the casualties found so far in the capital and in the eastern city of Benghazi.
Our estimation right now is that over 700 people died in Libya those last days. The information we have is that in Tripoli were found morgue nearby a hospital. This morgue takes place in a school, and in the school, 450 bodies were found. So this is in Tripoli. In Benghazi, 230 bodies were found. And in this hall, there is 130 soldiers that were shot by their officers because they refused to shoot on the protesters.
And that disturbing picture has been enough, more than enough, for many residents. Rather than wait to see how this struggle will be resolved, they're attempting to flee. Gérard Le Tradu is the regional representative for North Africa at the International Federation for the Red Cross and Red Crescent. He says he and his colleagues in neighbouring Tunisia are preparing for a massive influx.
Around 5,000 people have crossed the border from Libya, and mainly Tunisian people, but also Libyan and sub-Saharan Western African people. We have an assessment team now going to the border with Libya in Tunisia, and the same, we are preparing that the same with the Egyptian Red Crescent. On the other side, we are going to prepare ourselves to a massive influx, because it's an option that we won't have something like 2,000 people coming from Libya in the Tunisia border, but we are prepared to receive 10,000 per day.
Well, our correspondent Jim Muir has been to Libya's western border with Tunisia. I asked him if it's correct to say that it's already been a massive influx into Tunisia.
There is certainly an influx, but I wouldn't call it massive. I mean, there's been a steady trickle for the last 3 days. On Monday, around about 2,800 people crossed the border, I was told by the Red Crescent. The following day, Tuesday, there was a slight drop to 2,300. And now, the latest Wednesday, I would say it's a bit more than that. It's probably about more like 3,000, 4,000, something like that. But only a few thousand. It's a steady trickle rather than a torrent. They're coming across in a stream, but as I say, it's not a vast deluge of humanity. It's a few thousand per day, not masses, and very few of them Libyans, actually. The large majority are Tunisians coming home, or Algerians or Egyptian workers make up the bulk of them.
And briefly, Jim, what sort of testimony are you hearing from them?
Well, they're all surprisingly calm. I didn't get any sense that they had been traumatized. Some I talked to said the situation in Tripoli was quite calm, although they heard a bit of shooting as they were leaving. And they just seemed, to be honest, to look at them like normal travelers, except a lot of them quite poor, carrying their things not in suitcases but in bundles. A lot of them are manual workers, obviously. So it's not a situation of people coming across in great distress, I have to say.
And that was Jim Muir in Tunisia. It is continuing to be very difficult to get reliable phone lines and perspectives from inside Libya. But my colleague Pascal Harter has been following developments in the country from here in Bush House.
What Jim was saying from the border of Tunisia is not surprising when you put it in the context of what we're hearing, which is that Libyans are not being allowed to leave the capital, Tripoli. Scarcely foreigners are. We spoke to one Egyptian who'd made it safely across the border. He said that 150 other Egyptians working in Tripoli had not been allowed to leave by Gaddafi forces, that they were stopped and forced to stay there, stranded in the capital. We've also been hearing from Libyans abroad that their relatives are trying to go to the airport, trying to leave, and also not being able to escape. There's a real sense of fear in the city, and that's partly because the extent of the violence visited on the protesters in the east is now becoming clearer. We've been speaking to a French doctor, Gérard Bouffet, who was working long-term in Benghazi, and he has been telling us the situation in the hospital there when the violence and the attacks against the protesters began on the 17th of February. He spoke of real reprisals from the police, which were surprisingly brutal.
The first day, the police in Benghazi made a war with dead people around the police building, with people they'd killed.
With killed people.
They made a wall of dead bodies around the police building?
They want to say to the population, come, come, it's not possible to arrive.
Dr. Bouffet said that at first the police and mercenary forces working for Gaddafi attacked protesters with guns, that there were people going in with wounds the size of a fist, for example, in their abdomen, in their chest and their back, and that then jet fighters came. Mortars were used on the protesters, he said, and also rocket grenades. He and his Libyan colleagues worked round the clock, operating for 4 days straight, and he feels really that there ought to be some help for what he said of very peaceful protesters.
There are two solutions. Either the Libyan people, the young people, stop this devil, or the world stops this devil. But I think right now it is necessary to help the population. It's a quiet population.
It's a very quiet population.
A quiet population, peaceful.
A quiet population, not
a quiet population. That means they're not Islamists or anything like that. It is necessary to help the people. I think it is a good thing for the world to help the Libyans. In 2 or 3 days, it will be too late.
It's too late.
Dr. Bouffet says that some of his medical students were among the protesters, and he would now put the number of people killed by Gaddafi forces in the east around Benghazi at 2,000. That's not including the deaths in the capital. Our latest reports from the capital also speak of snipers roaming the streets, shooting people if they gathered together in groups of more than two, and also of a clean-up operation, anti-Gaddafi slogans being whitewashed off the billboards, bodies cleaned off the streets, and very much an attempt to show that the city had returned to normal. But the people we spoke to said that the city was quiet because they were so scared.
That was Pascal Harter. Now, we're hearing that President Obama is due to speak in about an hour about the situation in Libya. But in the meantime, the United States Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, has been talking in Washington about what's been happening in the country. She said that the US would look at all possible options to end the violence.
First, we have to get the international community together, because there is no doubt in my mind that this is now the moment for the international community to act together. And to that end, we joined a very strong United Nations Security Council statement yesterday. We are consulting closely because we are joining with the rest of the world in sending a clear message to the Libyan government. That violence is unacceptable, and that the Libyan government will be held accountable for the actions that it is taking.
So a promise of continued international pressure on the Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. While it's easy shorthand to describe him as autocratic, and he certainly is, it's also true that no one can hope to control a country the size of Libya single-handedly. So who are the key figures in the inner circle? Well, the man known as Colonel Gaddafi's chief enforcer is his brother-in-law, Abdullah Senussi. And someone who knows about Mr. Senussi is Mansour El-Kikia, chair of the political science department at the University of Texas, San Antonio.
This chap is really a mystery to many Libyans. They only hear about him. Very few actually see him. We know he's Gaddafi's brother-in-law, and we know that Gaddafi trusts him to a large degree to do his dirty work for him. He executes what Gaddafi wants. In a sense, if we see Gaddafi as a mafia don, Senussi is one of those individuals who take out the orders, and he does it to keep Gaddafi's hands clean.
So tell me how far Abdullah Senussi has been involved in events in Benghazi.
He has been very involved. I mean, he went to Benghazi to quell the disturbances and the riots. And what they did is individuals who actually caught and they were taken to the last base that was liberated by Libyans. And they were used as human shields to prevent the Libyans from getting to Senussi and his supporters before they escaped. And thank goodness they did get to them before Senussi was able to kill any of those people. And Senussi escaped with the help of a number of officers who are now caught and are now under detention, and they're being interrogated. And in that same compound, over 300 people who were actually buried underground in some cells, they were released, and they're trying to ascertain who they were and why they were there. But Senussi's, that was his job. His job was to run these detention centers and to extract information, any information he wants, by torture and by... He's the executioner, really, in a way.
And how tight is the inner circle?
Very, very tight. As far as that, this is how Gaddafi worked. Senussi is very close to him now because due to blood ties.
Because he's married to a sister of Colonel Gaddafi's wife, is that correct?
He's married to Sophia's wife, Sophia's sister. And so there's blood ties between them. And Gaddafi has always made sure of this. He made sure that all his supporters understand very clearly that you are close to me through blood, and if you're not close to me through blood, you're close to me through your activities, your actions. This is why you have some popular committees, the revolutionary committees, now continuing the fight, because Gaddafi has informed them, if I go, you go. And he made to ensure that they actually do go. He had them commit atrocities over the last 30 or 40 years.
What's your best guess as to how things are going to play out then over the next days and weeks?
You know, it's very difficult. But the truth is, I'm really surprised by Libyans. And I'm surprised by how wise they are in a degree. Because they don't want the country to go back into a state of chaos under Gaddafi. And I'm looking at the interviews, watching the American media, talking to people over there. They're not talking in regional terms. They're not talking about Barga or Cyrenaica or Benghazi or so. They're talking about Libya. They're talking about a united Libya. It's not going to be easy. This is the most difficult part. Removing Gaddafi was an easy part. The difficult part now is reconstructing a system that guarantees freedom and safety and honesty for all Libyans. Now, how long that will take? You know, you've got to give them a chance. They've been under 40 years in prison. Now, and now they, all of a sudden, they're left free. They don't know they're free yet. They're going to make some mistakes. They're going to have some problems, but I think it will work out. We'll just have to wait and see. The most important thing now for the Libyans is actually to remove this ogre off their back. And once that happens, I promise you, Libyans will surprise the world the same way they surprised the world today.
And that was Professor Mansour El-Kikia. It seems that eastern Libya continues to prize itself further from the grip of Colonel Gaddafi. Benghazi and the other major cities on that side of the country appear firmly to be in the control of the protesters. Our correspondent John Lyne is travelling in eastern Libya.
This whole area is under opposition control, of course, or I wouldn't be here. The town I'm in, for example, we saw there's a government building burning fairly furiously. Opposition supporters out on the streets protesting and maybe really celebrating. They're waving the old flag of Libya, the royalist flag, and life is a kind of normality has returned. Let me tell you, though, what I've been seeing today, because we went to one of the main air bases in this area, in the middle of the east of Libya, and this air base, after the protests started and the government lost control of a lot of the area, they tried to bring in reinforcements, special forces, elite forces, and also what are described as these foreign mercenaries, mostly from other parts of Africa. Now, when local people heard about that in these various towns along the north coast, Tobruk, Al Baida, Benghazi, they called on people around the airbase to try and prevent this, because people were literally being flown into the airbase, then bussed down to these towns to attack the protesters. And local people, local young people, initially unarmed, completely unarmed except sticks and stones, went and surrounded that airbase and took on those special forces, and then eventually got some kind of weapons from army bases and looted army bases, and they took on those special forces and they have defeated them. After 5 days, those forces have gone. The last ones have been captured. We saw the wreckage left at the airport where they'd left behind, and they were defeated by young, very determined young people. They showed us pictures and they gave us evidence of attacks from the Libyan Air Force, both jet attacks on a civilian house and also helicopter attacks on those civilian protesters. And we have footage of that helicopter gunship attacking them.
John Lyne in eastern Libya. It's not just Libya's North African neighbours who are watching events with some concern. So is the island of Malta in the Mediterranean. Keith Demacoli is a journalist with TV Radio Malta. I asked him about a Libyan plane which was apparently refused permission to land in Malta today.
There were some reports on international media that on board the plane there were some 14 Libyan citizens, including the daughter of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, daughter Aisha Gaddafi. However, a few minutes ago, the government of Malta denied claims that he had some sort of information that on board the plane there was the daughter of Colonel Gaddafi, and also he denied claims or indication that there was some communications between the aircraft and the control tower in the Malta International Airport that the daughter of Colonel Gaddafi was on board the aircraft. These are the official reports from the government of Malta regarding the reports on international media that the daughter of Colonel Gaddafi was on board the plane.
But did they explain why they turned the plane away, though?
No explanation whatsoever, but they just denied the claims about the daughter of Gaddafi. It comes as no surprise, however, for local journalists, local media, local observers, since there is this widespread condemnation against the Libyan authorities. I guess the Maltese government was wise enough, I guess I would say, I would put it that way, to refuse the plane to land in the Malta International Airport.
What they did allow, though, a couple of days ago, was two Libyan fighter pilots to land. What's happened to them?
Yeah, however, it was unexpected. Officials from the control tower and from the Maltese authorities, they said they had no idea that the planes were coming over to Malta, and it was just a few kilometers away from the Malta International Airport that they noticed that the plane, that the both jets were landing in Malta. And of course, as we've heard in the last few days, they landed in Malta following a request since they had no fuel. They were running out of fuel, and they claimed they had an emergency, and they landed in Malta.
And do we know what's happened to the fighter pilot since?
They're still in custody. The armed forces of Malta seems they're requesting a political asylum in Malta. And of course, the government of Malta, even a few minutes ago, he said regarding the two colonels that their request will be processed as usual, as normal procedures, and the government of Malta will provide all necessary protection to the Libyan colonels who arrived last Monday.
That was Keith Demicoli in Malta. The incident of the two Libyan fighter pilots that landed there a couple of days ago has raised a number of questions, not least because the planes were Russian-made, where Libya gets its extensive range of military hardware from. Guy Anderson is Chief Defence Industrial Analyst with Jane's Defence. How much has Libya been buying in recent years?
Quite extensive, actually, mainly because Libya is such an interesting market. Europeans have been able to sell since 2004, still closed off to the United States. So if we look at some of the deals the last few years, Russia in particular, we've seen main battle tanks, fighter aircraft, training aircraft. There's been much talk of missile defense systems as well, of course. So it's very, very extensive. From Europeans, we've seen communications equipment, border security technologies, of course.
And what sort of money are we talking about here? Does it run into hundreds of millions, billions of dollars?
Oh, billions in some cases. The Russian package, now that was announced in 2010, that ran to something like $1.8 billion. Now, France and Libya announced a package worth something like 4 billion euros in 2007. Very little came of that subsequently, but it's been interesting. The scale of the deals have been enormous, considering that Libya is a relatively small market. Now, in terms of defense spending, it's probably about on a par with Austria or, say, Morocco.
And when a country from the European Union sells to a place like Libya, are there controls, self-imposed controls, as to what can be sold and assurances as to how this equipment is used?
The thing with the European Union and the member states, of course, is that arms sales are tightly controlled, so there would be certain assurances regarding the end use of equipment.
Assurances such as what? That they won't be used in internal repression?
Typically, yes. It varies greatly country by country, of course, but the idea that an arms sale would proceed, no questions asked, is absolute fantasy. There are an awful lot of checks and balances.
But are these assurances worth the paper they're written on?
Well, that's the question. That varies according to the market.
In Libya, the evidence seems to suggest otherwise.
Yes, that's always the issue. Equipment isn't used for civilian oppression until the day it's used for civilian oppression, and at which point it's very, very difficult to turn back the clock and pull the plug, so to speak.
David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, has just gone on a tour of the region, partly to talk about democracy, but also partly to try and encourage rulers in the region to buy British arms. Do you think that there's any pressure on the British government at all to try and tighten its rules of engagement in these defence sales?
Well, I think the UK protocols are pretty tight to begin with. And there's always a risk as well of lumping all of the Middle East in together. Of course, the dynamics and the situations in, say, the Gulf states and North African states differ drastically.
That was Guy Anderson from Jane's Defence. And we've had a few texts on the subject of Libya. Hafiz in Painesville, Liberia, has texted us to say, retreat, Colonel Gaddafi, empires fall, dynasties end and dictatorships expire. Do you read me, Colonel? Well, Mohammed in Freetown offers some rare support for the Colonel. Gaddafi, don't worry, be happy, he writes. People think you're not legitimate, but they will come to realise very soon. Just keep on going strong. And Idris in Ghana sent this. I believe Mr. Gaddafi is indeed a mad dog that needs to be tamed by all means before he bites his own people. You can send your own SMS to us on 44 77 86 20 60 80, and you can email us as well at worldhaveyoursay@bbc.com.
BBC News with David Austin. The Libyan leader, Colonel Gaddafi, is battling to keep control of western Libya, including the capital Tripoli, as opposition protesters, supported by many defecting government troops, consolidate their control in the east of the country. Residents of Tripoli have said they're too frightened to venture out. The International Federation for Human Rights says at least 700 people have died in Libya since the uprising began. More details have been emerging of how unarmed Libyans were able to take on and defeat the country's forces at an airbase in the east. A BBC correspondent says the government tried to use the base to bring in special forces to crush the uprising. But when local people heard about this, they rushed to the airbase, armed only with sticks and stones. The American Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, has stressed that those responsible for the violence against civilians in Libya must be held to account. Speaking in Washington, she said the US would look at all possible options to end the violence. Foreigners in Libya are fleeing the turmoil caused by the uprising. China, the United States, and many European countries have chartered planes and ships to evacuate their stranded nationals. In reaction to the continuing crisis, the price of oil has jumped sharply in international markets. In New York, it passed $100 a barrel for the first time since 2008. That's the BBC News.
The ricochets from the tumult in Egypt and Libya are being heard across the region. Even in those countries so far apparently untouched by protest, there appear to be tremors. In Saudi Arabia, King Abdullah has just returned after months of medical treatment abroad. The king, who's in his 80s, greeted his people on his arrival.
Dear brothers and sons who came to greet me, I would like to thank you and apologize that I could not greet you one by one. I also would like to greet all of my beloved Saudi people, men, women and children. I would like to thank them and I ask God to give them success and health.
And, surely no coincidence this, King Abdullah garlanded his arrival back with the announcement of a $37 billion benefit package to help lower income and poorer families. So what chance this will be enough to stave off unrest, if indeed there is any chance of unrest in Saudi? Well, on the line a little earlier, I spoke to Eman Al-Nafjan, a Saudi mother of three who lives in Riyadh and writes a blog called Saudi Woman. In a recent blog, she'd said that everywhere she goes and everything she reads points to a revolution in Saudi Arabia in the foreseeable future, but that the country is still on the ledge, as she puts it, and hasn't jumped yet. I asked her if the king's announcement had changed her assessment.
I think it's too early to say. Right now, it's a financial package, and he's just arrived. There's going to be a reshuffle on Friday. People are still patient.
Why are they patient? Is it because there isn't that much hardship in Saudi Arabia?
Actually, there is. The unemployment rate is crazy, very high, and standard of living has become very low, and the difference between classes, the middle class, is disappearing very quickly. So it's not as good as it should be.
Why in that case, if you say that the Saudis are patient, why are you so certain in that blog of the 18th of February that revolution is inevitable?
I didn't say it was inevitable. I said that Prince Fahd, when he came out, people felt that the message, that they got the message, that they knew that the people are frustrated. So people are waiting to see if the message got through to King Abdullah too. And another thing about King Abdullah is he's very popular. The people really love King Abdullah. It's just they don't believe in the system and they don't believe in the people around him.
And
they believe in him. So that's why they're patient. But I think that if it was anybody else but King Abdullah, they wouldn't be patient.
Do you sense that, it's difficult to know, of course, but do you sense that within the Saudi royal family that there might well be concern? From what I understand, King Abdullah had talks with the King of Bahrain on his return, and of course Bahrain, Saudi's neighbour, has seen considerable unrest.
Yes, that's true, but with Bahrain it's a different issue, because what they worry about is the eastern region rather than a whole country revolution. When it comes to unrest in Bahrain, the unrest will be in the eastern region, because then, we have a Shia minority, and they're concentrated in the eastern region. And if anything came from Bahrain, then it's probably going to affect the Shia in the eastern region.
That was Iman Al-Nafjan, resident of Riyadh, mother of three, and the blogger known as Saudi Woman. For the great socialist people's country, as Libya calls itself under the rule of Colonel Gaddafi, it's striking to note how extensive the ruling family's private business interests are internationally. According to diplomatic cables obtained by WikiLeaks and published in today's Financial Times newspaper in London, Gaddafi and children have strong interests in the oil and gas sector, telecommunications, hotels, media distribution and consumer goods distribution. So, should foreign governments, or indeed, at some point, a future new Libyan government, want to, how easy would it be to freeze the family's extensive assets? Tim Daniel is a London-based lawyer whose speciality is just this.
What is apparent from these cables is that, like so many of these people, it is a family concern. And the Gaddafi and his two wives have had, I think, about 8 or 9 children. And it is very common for all of the business, as it were, to be run through the family, through the children.
And this is business running into billions of dollars, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. Typically, it is literally billions. In the case of Abacha in Nigeria, he was in power for about 4.5 years, and they reckon that he amassed about $5 billion in that time. Case of Suharto, he was in for 30 years. And interestingly, it was a $70 billion figure, which was given by Time magazine, which is exactly the same as they're now quoting for Mubarak. When we actually got closer to it, it looked more like $15 billion, but it's still a lot of billions.
It's still a wedge of money, and there's still a lot of people who are saying now, in the same way that they shout arms embargo against Libya now, they're also shouting freeze the assets now of Muammar Gaddafi and his family. How easy is it to do that?
It's not easy. We don't have a law like the Swiss, and they have only just passed this law, which effectively enables them to go out and get information from all their financial institutions by government edict, and then to freeze those assets. As soon as they're declared, they are frozen. And they don't, at that stage, go into the question of where those assets came from. They don't distinguish between what may be ultimately government funds or which may be private funds. They just go, everything that has anything to do with, in that case, it gets frozen. A similar thing did happen with Abacha right at the outset. The Swiss did that, and then they went on and froze as well. But we don't have that mechanism here.
But even if you did have that mechanism to freeze those assets immediately, I presume then disentangling what is the family's and what is the government's when the regime is in effect the family, is incredibly difficult.
It is indeed. And one always meets, well, basically two objections. One is that these are legitimate business interests, and the other is that the target is being politically victimised. These people, they have an enormous amount of money which is available to hire the very best legal advice. And the lawyers will take every trick that they can in order to resist the attack on the assets. In the case of Abacha, he died in 1998. Some of the monies were returned as a result of a Supreme Court decision in Switzerland in 2005. So that was 7 years. And Switzerland, was on a steep learning curve as far as this was concerned, but it took them a very long time. I think it would take a very long time here as well.
Should we be doing more to stop people such as the Gaddafis being able to invest billions of dollars in, for example, in Britain?
Well, it's a very good question. In an ideal world, one would like to see perhaps legislation passed which would monitor this kind of thing. But what we do have, two things that we do have, which are, as it were, on our side. One is that in the wake, particularly of the UN Convention Against Corruption, politically exposed persons, or PEPs, are routinely kept under observation by Western governments. And we have a sector, a section of the Metropolitan Police and the Serious and Organised Crime Agency who do just that. So I would suspect that they already have quite a hefty dossier on Gaddafi and the family interests. The other thing which has happened literally in the last week is for the Treasury to issue a circular to all financial institutions and to professionals such as lawyers and accountants, anybody who keeps money on behalf of a client, warning them that they should touch Egyptian or Libyan assets with the greatest of caution. And indeed, if one has any suspicion that these may be illegitimate funds, one should immediately report these under our money laundering legislation to the Serious and Organised Crime Agency. So that directive has gone out. So everybody is on notice in the financial sector that there could be dirty money which they will try and launder through our system. Now, the effect of that, of course, is that if they do then proceed to handle the money, they will be setting themselves up as targets at a later date for possible legal action.
That was Tim Daniel on the multinational business interests of Gaddafi and Sons. A reminder of today's main news, forces loyal to Colonel Gaddafi are fighting to keep control of Western Libya as his opponents consolidate their gains in the east. Our correspondent Jim Muir is on the Tunisian side of Libya's western border and he's been watching Libyans leave.
It's a steady trickle rather than a torrent. They're coming across in a stream, but as I say, it's not a vast deluge of humanity. It's a few thousand per day, not masses.
We'll hear from a resident of Tripoli before the end of the programme. And oil prices have risen sharply because of the turmoil in Libya. In other news, New Zealand's Prime Minister says it's unlikely that more survivors will be found from Tuesday's earthquake in Christchurch. As I mentioned earlier in the programme, the US Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, has been speaking about what's happening in Libya. President Obama is due to speak in the next half an hour, but let's hear a bit more of what Mrs. Clinton had to say as she was answering questions during a press conference with a Brazilian foreign minister in Washington.
Well, first, let me say I think that the United States, starting with what the president said on Friday, what I reiterated yesterday, have made it absolutely clear that we strongly condemn the violence in Libya, that we have called for an end to violence against protesters and those who are seeking the rights that are due to any people, anywhere. And we deeply regret the loss of life that has already occurred.
Well, Mrs. Clinton's words may yet be noted in Tripoli, but whether they will have an impact on Muammar Gaddafi and his supporters is another matter. Reliable reports about the state of mind of members of the ruling family in Libya is, to put it mildly, rare. But David Owen has just had one insight. He writes for the Financial Times in London, and he's been speaking to one of Colonel Gaddafi's sons. He told me which one.
I've been talking to Sadi, Muammar's second son.
And he's the one who played professional football in Italy, intriguingly.
He's the one, yes.
And what did he have to say?
Well, I was astonished by how relaxed he sounded, given the reports we're hearing. I mean, I've not been out there. I don't know the situation on the ground, but I was expecting him to sound rather tense and fraught. He actually sounded incredibly relaxed and seemed to be under the impression that they would sooner or later regain control of the East, and that while he actually hopes that, or so he says, that there'll be reforms, he expects his father to remain head of state, albeit in perhaps rather more ceremonial capacity than an executive one.
So he was prepared to talk about possible reforms to the way in which His father runs the country.
He's quite keen on the idea of reforms. He's said this to me before, so that it's not particularly surprising.
Does he have any sway within the family, do you think?
He is not. He said himself he's not in the inner circle, but yes, he does have sway. He's, like I say, the second son. In terms of what relative to the immediate things, he told me that his elder brother, Saif, is at work on proposals for a new constitution.
From what you say, it sounds as if he genuinely, if you can use that adverb, but he certainly wants to give the impression that he thinks the country is still salvageable as far as his family is concerned.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, time and time again, he was sort of putting a completely different gloss on the events as they've been reported here. To give you an example, he admitted that they had sent planes to Benghazi to bombard ammunition depots, but he insisted that these were not in populated areas and they were outside the city, not inside the city. The reason he said they had to do that is because Al-Qaeda is in control of the east, as he says, and those facilities were no longer secure, so he was worried, or they were worried about where the weapons might end up.
And I don't want to be a killjoy about this, David, but you are certain that it was son number two that you were speaking
to? Yeah, no, I quite understand. I've interviewed him face-to-face three times before in Europe, and that's why I'm 100% sure it was him. And that's why I was so amazed how relaxed he sounded, because he sounded pretty much as he had on the previous times when I'd been sitting in various luxury hotels talking to him.
And he was in Tripoli, as far as I
know. He was in Tripoli, yeah. I'm not sure where in Tripoli, but he was in Tripoli. I mean, he told me that last week, when the problems started in Benghazi, he had persuaded his father to let him go there. So he went to Benghazi on Thursday to talk to the protesters, as he puts it. What he said to me was that Friday morning the situation was relatively calm.
David Owen, a Financial Times journalist with something of a scoop. Amid all the clamour and confusion from Libya, it's been difficult to get reports from the ground, especially in the capital. International journalists are currently banned. Some of the residents of Tripoli, though, have found ways of staying in contact with people outside the country. Among them, this man, Nasir.
Today is it's a totally different day than the other days we had. First of all, because the weather was so cold and we had very strong rain, which that kept the protesters inside their house. But last night, after the leader's speech, people got confused, threatened, scared, didn't know what to go on. People they started to not to trust each other, particularly in Tripoli, because, I mean, when you contact a person, the first question you say, you're with or without? Are you with the Gaddafi or without the Gaddafi? If he says he's with, so you have to be careful with the conversation.
Tell me what you have seen yourself today.
I have seen, I mean, in Tejoura, which is really the biggest protesters are, so they put some tanks in the streets of Tejoura. So there's an army, is protected by the army. Actually, the protesters are so happy about it because that stops killing people. You understand? Because they, at least to keep the situation is under control by the army. We believe in army in general. We trust in the army because the army is still Libyans. I mean, Libyans, no matter what, they won't kill each other.
And what is life like when you do venture out, or in terms of just trying to run a family in a normal way? Do you have food? Do you have fuel?
For fuel today, I went fueled my car, so there was a little bit queue. I mean, it wasn't that long. I mean, there were just a few vehicles in front of me because, as I told you, the rain, so I used this opportunity and I managed to go out. But the problem is that every time when you go out, you have to take your family with you. I'm not saying that I'm so scared to keep them inside their houses, but they are so scared if I go alone. So they prefer to be with me. First of all, to see what's happening outside. I mean, and to be safe. When they're with me, they feel like they're a little bit safe. I mean, there's some checkpoints on the roads by military, just checkpoints. Normally, when they see you with the family, there's respect. They just let you pass by. But if there's like three guys or four guys in a vehicle, they stop and they check for identification and they open the trunk. There are text messages going on here in Tripoli. Some of them, they say by the government that tomorrow they want everybody back to work. I mean, the teachers, the schools, I mean, they shut down the life in a way itself. It's stopped. I mean, it's sort of like Tripoli is sort of like handicapped in a way. But I have to go to work. My kids, they're sort of like they're begging me that they want to go with me. They don't want to be left back home alone.
So in a way, you're going to have to carry on a semblance of normality by going to work. But all around you, it's presumably not like anything you've experienced before.
Totally. We have never experienced this kind of situation. I mean, today we're safe. Today, the life in Tripoli particularly, it's safe. We don't know what's happening tomorrow or what will happen tomorrow. Today, the airport, I mean, I went to the airport. It's too difficult to get inside the airport because hundreds and hundreds people are leaving. There's no one you can talk to. I mean, there's so much pressure on the handling, the check-in counter. 99% of the travelers who are leaving at the airport, they don't have confirmation, tickets or anything. So they just go rush at the airport, just trying to get seats. And the prices of the ticket just increase, just pop up, almost triple the prices. Everybody, doesn't matter what cost of the ticket, just want to leave. I mean, I've seen the confusion and the fear of the people. We call it days of nightmares. I mean, people seeing nightmares in daylight.
That was Nasser talking from the south of Tripoli. Keep listening if you can. We're expecting President Obama to speak about Libya within the next half an hour. But for the time being, from me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the NewsHour team, goodbye.